an informal discussion here. It's not a requirement of the class. It's just if you want to look at some deeper questions about the various experiments we're doing. So we'll try to, perhaps this Thursday, show you some strangeness with delayed choice experiments, if that means anything to you. And there's a set of interpretations of delayed choice experiments with neutrons that are on the web that are a little bit crazy. So we'll give you better physics than that. On the notes, has everyone got the notes now? Yes? Good. In CDF players. In the first version I sent you, although it wasn't used in that file, I defined the inverse of the mirror operation, dropping a minus one, the negative sign. So I've corrected that. So there's an updated file that's on the web now, right? Oh, okay. Well, use the updated file, because otherwise you're going to find some strange physics where you're allowed to do an inversion through the origin unitarily. And that wouldn't be nice. Or maybe it would be nice, but it doesn't correspond to the physics that we know. In terms of the problems, I think if you want to get the most out of the class, you should do the problems as they're listed. And Sarah's going to tell you which one she's going to grade, or she and her colleagues are going to grade. So if you go through the problems, I mean, there's a lot of problems there. Many of them are really trivial. Maybe the ones I think are trivial aren't the ones you think are trivial. So have a look, and you'll communicate what you want to be handed in. But have a look at them all anyways. And go through the notes, because I'm not going to cover all that material, right? So it's just good background material to have a look. Now, last class, what did we do? Last class, we gave you really the simplest picture of a quantum device. And so it's no different than what you saw, I hope, in your first semester quantum mechanics course. And so now then, I want to go a bit beyond that. So we took our neutron interferometer and we described it in some idealized case. So in order to describe it, I'm going to label the eigenstates of the two paths of the neutron interferometer in terms of their x momentum. So if kx is greater than 0, we'll call that 1, 0. And if kx is less than 0, it would be the other basis state. And into the neutron interferometer, we only have one path that impinges on it. And then we create a coherent superposition between two paths of the interferometer. The middle blade acts as a mirror. The two paths are recombined. At the third blade, we put in a phase flag so I can create a phase difference between those two paths. And then based upon this phase flag, then we see contrast at our two detectors. And we quickly derive that contrast. So the intensity at this detector is 1 plus cosine of the angle divided by 2. And here, the complementary piece. And of course, it's nice that the contrast adds up to 1, so that if we send a neutron through this interferometer, it is in fact detected at the end. I want to make a couple of points here. One, you'll often hear things like the neutron takes both paths. And of course, that's bullshit, right? The neutron, I was abusing Feynman last class, and we continue to abuse him, that Feynman was, of course, asked about the wave-particle duality in terms of a photon. And his answer was, do you know? The photon is a particle. The neutron is a particle. It behaves via wave mechanics. Okay? And here, if I put these detectors over here, then of course what I'm going to see is I will see one or the other click. It will never happen that they both click. The neutron's never in both paths. In the wave function, remember that we have this requirement of the wave function, that the wave function is a complete description of the information we can obtain about a quantum system. We don't want it to think that the wave function is describing some reality, right? The wave function is telling us about the information that we can get from a system. Yeah? Okay. It's an experimental. That's the entire experimentalist version of foundations. So we have our neutron interferometer. We have one neutron. It goes through. The wave function has an interference effect. The interference effect is observed in the contrast of these two. And also, I want to point out here that this phase flag could equally be in this arm. So it's easy to see that by moving that phase flag, I don't change the physics at all. Now, neutron interferometry. It's the world's best way of studying neutron interactions with matter. And neutron interactions with matter are great. The neutron is light, right? And so it scatters off hydrogen. So if I have neutron hydrogen scattering, I can determine the locations of hydrogen in, for instance, a protein, just as you would look at heavier elements by doing X-ray scattering. X-ray scattering, of course, doesn't reveal light elements. So we could say, I want to know where the waters are in some hydrated protein. We could study that. Neutrons penetrate. They have no charge. So a wonderful application of neutron interferometry is to look at hydrogen embrittlement in metals. If I have a metal, let's say steel, and I put it in a reactor, your favorite neutron reactor, a nuclear reactor, then what will happen is with damage, we'll create pools, pockets of hydrogen, and it'll embrittle the steel. And that's very hard to observe, right? Because you can't get something into the metal to see it. But of course, you can send neutrons through. Neutrons will be transparent for the metal. But they'll still scatter off hydrogen. Neutron has a magnetic moment. So it's a great way of looking at internal fields. If you're trying to study spintronics, then you can send a neutron through material. You can understand the internal structures of fields. Another application actually of this one, neutrons are used for fuel cell research or for battery research. That again, you have a steel casing, you'd like to know what's happening inside of it. Neutrons have mass. So we can use a neutron interferometer to measure gravity. So we can use a neutron interferometer to measure gravity waves. You know, it's a lot smaller than LIGO. And that happens anyways. You want to see the moon rise? You can see the moon rise. And there's a bunch of standard model experiments. You want to know, you know, the neutron has a finite lifetime. That we know pretty well. But there's a correlation between the photon that's emitted and the lifetime that we're just starting to know. There's a bound on the electric dipole moment of the neutron. We don't know that as precisely as models predict. So we'd like to study those. So there's lots of reasons that we would want to do to study neutrons. And neutron interferometry is absolutely the best way of studying neutrons because it takes a phase difference and it returns it as an intensity difference. Hard to measure phase. Easy to measure amplitudes. Easy to measure whether there's a neutron there or not. So neutron interferometry is the best way of doing something important, and it's never done. In fact, there's only two really good neutron interferometers in the world. And the reason is that the neutron is sensitive to all of these things. And so when we build a neutron interferometer, we find that it's sensitive to every environmental effect. That if the temperature of the room changes by a thousandth of a degree Kelvin, we can see that. If a truck goes by, we can see that. If the, well, as I said, if the gravitational field changes, we can see that. And so we have this challenge of saying, yes, we have this very sensitive, very quantum device, but it's sensitive to so many things that we can't use it specifically for what we would like to use it for. And that's what we're going to talk about. We're going to tell you how to take this neutron interferometer as a prototype quantum device, something that we can get our hands around, and understand why it's sensitive and how it's sensitive to various aspects of its environment or imperfections in the design of the interferometer, and then how to make it robust so that we can actually use it now. And we lead a project at NIST to develop neutron interferometers for all of those things. So this is active work. But we'll talk about it in not that much detail. Okay. So I want to take this interferometer and I want to reinterpret it. And so what I'm going to do is to say, oh, well, we have this unitary at the first blade, which we described the physics of and wrote down this way. And then I can remember that the unitary always, or in SU2, always must be a rotation on the Bloch sphere, right? And so we can ask, well, what is the equivalent rotation that I would have for this? And the rotations on a Bloch sphere are always going to be written like so. And you'll remember that the components of the Pauli square to the identity, this is just a projector, right? This is just a unit matrix that tells us where the axis is we're rotating about. So just think about that as a vector somewhere on the Bloch sphere. And the angle comes in as the angle divided by 2 because we're using Pauli's. And if you haven't taken this description, expanded it in a Taylor series, used the fact that the Pauli is square to the identity, and seen the dynamics, you should do that. But I'm assuming that almost all of you, or maybe even all of you, have. So then I can write this out, that this is a Y rotation. And it's a Y rotation of an angle of pi over 2. So here we have a Y rotation by pi over 2. And similarly, we had the unitary for the mirror, which is a pi rotation about Y. The phase flag, which is a phi rotation about Z. And finally, the last blade is exactly the same. It's a pi over 2 rotation about Y. So now then, we can take and say, well, if I look on the Bloch sphere at this particular experiment. So I've got the Bloch sphere, and we'll take the North Pole and the South Pole as our two eigenstates, In the neutron interferometry experiment, we start off here. And then we have a simple rotation that takes us to the x-axis. And then there's a rotation, so that's the first blade. And then there's this mirror. So that's blade one. Then there's the mirror that takes us here. And then from there, there's a rotation by phi about the z-axis. And of course, that's the information that we want to keep, right? But we'll come back to that. But there's some rotation about phi. And you can see that if I let phi have any possible angle, then we would spread out in the xy plane, right? And then the final blade takes that plane and it rotates it up to the yz plane, right? And so the final result is that we have this plane of states modulated by that angle phi. And of course, the intensities we're looking at are those along the z-axis. So our contrast here Our contrast is, of course, the probability that if I have a state, then when I make a projective measurement, a von Neumann measurement, I end up along the plus z or the minus z axis. Right? Yes?
There I see phi written as a point, at the points, but which angle?
So. Depending upon how we rotate the phase flag, we can get any value of phi.
But let's say in this diagram, is it from the positive z-axis?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, absolutely. Yeah, that's the angle phi. Thanks. Yep. Okay. So here, this is things that you've still seen before, I hope. And when I say that, and you object, you know, you can object. You don't have to throw something at me, but you can object. Okay, so this piece, we make it a little bit more concrete when we say, well, how would we use a neutron interferometer to measure any of those aspects? Well, what we would do is we'd make two measurements. We make one measurement just like we've done here. And then we make a second measurement by placing a sample here. And as we make that second measurement, of course, see if I can get this right. There'll be some change in the fringes. So this curve is called a contrast curve. And the oscillations are normally called fringes. And so these are Ramsey fringes after Norman Ramsey, who was the first one to describe this experiment. And you will see when we talk about spins, or we talk about any quantum system, that we'll talk about a Ramsey fringe experiment. And it always has this structure. It always says you start with an eigenstate, create a state of equal superposition, introduce a phase, so rotate that superposition, and then project it back on to the eigenstate so that you can measure the lifetime of that superposition. Yes?
That is quite a bit. I'm not quite understanding. I think you said you measure it twice?
We do the experiment twice. I do the experiment with the interferometer empty. I do the experiment with the sample in the interferometer. And because the sample is going to introduce a phase, then the fringes are pushed over. Yeah? Yeah?
Might sample also change things like velocity?
So that's a good question. So the sample, of course, changes the velocity while the neutron is in the sample, right? That's how we get a change in phase.
Right.
But, of course, it doesn't change the velocity here.
Because where there's a phase shift.
So there could be, right? That one could have a material that absorbs neutrons. It becomes a less interesting experiment if you're looking for absorption, right? But clearly, one could have a material that absorbs neutrons. Usually, if we want to look at an absorption cross-section, then there's no reason to look at a phase. If we're looking at a coherent scattering cross-section, or just a coherence, you know, effectively a change in the refractive index, then we're looking at phase. Yeah? Yes?
You suggested this set of two measurements in order to measure these characteristics. I wasn't sure what you meant by these characteristics.
The ones there.
Oh, sorry. I just don't quite understand how these two measurements imply anything about these characteristics.
If I have a light beam, and I put a sample of water there, then the photons will be slowed down. And if I take two light beams and I send one of them through there, and I look at the interference effects, then I can tell how much it slowed down. It's the same thing we're doing here, right? We're saying, oh, I'm going to take a neutron. And in the sample, okay, we'll pick up a phase. The phase could be dependent upon the hydrogen concentration, it could be dependent upon the humidity of the room, could be dependent upon the magnetic properties. And in your notes in lecture one, I give you a big table of all these cross sections and show you how to calculate the solve Schrodinger's equation in 1D to see the phase difference. Right? That's all you're doing. You're saying for each of these, there is a cross section. So each of these corresponds to a potential. And if I have a plane wave that goes through a potential, so when the neutron's moving here, think about it as in the vacuum. And so we have no potential. I move it here, then I have a potential. Okay, so now I've changed the momentum of that neutron wave, right? And then it will come back. And I will follow this up in a few minutes. Okay, so we'll see it again. Good. All right, so here, we're picking up this phase. So let's call it delta phi, delta phi. And it's that phase that I want to measure. Okay? Now we saw the first piece of an imperfection in a neutron interferometer that, in general, U1 And it's a little bit nicer if I put factors of two there. U1 looks like that. That in general, the rotation of the first blade need not be pi over 2. It could be any angle. And remember that we looked at the experimental contrast curves. And the experimental contrast curves did not look like the idealized contrast curves, the experimental contrast curves. So if we had the ideal contrast curves, they look like this, where we have intensity versus phase. And those are the two detectors. And what we saw instead was that we had a set of contrast curves that looked roughly like that, experimentally. That things didn't quite go to zero, and we didn't see the full visibility of these. Okay? And so I suggest to you that here's one reason why. Okay, and since you guys don't ask enough of questions, except for one person here, take 2 minutes right now and draw what you expect of the trajectory on the Bloch sphere when I replace the idealized first blade with this one. And make theta sort of small, 30 degrees or so. Okay? I want to see everyone take out a piece of paper, draw something. You don't have to be quiet. You can talk to your neighbors.
So would it be like the effect of having in general U1? Would it be like adding a factor in front of the plus 5? Actually, it's some scalar, which is less than 1. So that the intensity doesn't go to 0.
Oh, you mean up here?
Yeah, up here.
Thank you.
Yep.
So, okay, let's...
That would be like 1 plus a plus 5 divided by 2.
So it would reduce that fringe, right?
Yeah.
Is it still a pure state?
No.
So before you answer, let's ask that to the whole class. So the question is that the observation is correct, that by putting in this rotation that is less than pi over 2, we're going to reduce the fringe visibility. And so we're going to go to a case that really looks like these dotted lines. And so it looks like, you know, let's take this curve and let me redraw it. So we have a curve that looks like this. So it looks like there's some piece here which is independent of the interference of those two neutron beams. Okay? That's what it looks like. In fact, that is the right physics as well. But now, we're asking the overall question, is the process, is this whole thing unitary?
Well, it's still a unitary, right? So it should still be pure state.
So perfect. So here you say, oh yes, that because it because we start with the pure state, and we're only applying unitary evolution, the final piece must be pure as well. Okay? And if we looked at the equivalent of this block sphere. So now we rotate by a small amount there. So that's the first rotation. It's the first blade. And then the mirror is still perfect. That's a little bit of magic because we throw away neutrons. We always get a perfect mirror. So this goes down to here. So this angle was theta. That angle is still theta. And then we have the phase rotation. So we still have the possibility that it could be anywhere in that disk. But that disk remains on the surface of the block sphere. And then that disk is rotated by theta over 2, by theta, sorry, in this case. And so we end up having it just rotated over about here. And so we can see that there's a loss of contrast, right? That if I'm measuring along the minus direction, then I always get this little piece. And as I am measuring up here, then I see just a smaller modulation, right? And it's easy to show, you should do it, that as I increase theta, of course, we go to that picture. That's no surprise. Okay, but this doesn't capture the physics I want yet, because we're still in the block sphere, we're still looking at unitary dynamics. So now, I'm going to try to answer your question, and we'll redo this. So let me modify the neutron interferometer. And we'll go back to the case where the blades work perfectly. Okay? So here, we're still saying that we have a pi over 2 rotation about y, and a pi rotation about y, and some phi rotation about z, another pi over 2 about y. And what I want to do is to put in an area of a magnetic field here. It along the z-axis. Now neutrons have spin. And if I take my neutron from the reactor, the spin degree of freedom is a really low energy degree of freedom. So if I look at an individual neutron, the spin will be up or the spin will be down. And so as neutrons come into our experiment, unless we've done something, then the neutron spin will be half the time spin up and half the time spin down. And I want to make sure that you understand that this is not to say that we have a coherent superposition between those states. That if I have an individual neutron, then it is up or it is down. Okay? So this, of course, already gives us a mixed state. But I'm not going to worry about the spin degree of freedom, because here I've defined the state of the neutron along the z-axis. And the only magnetic field I'm going to allow in my experiment is along the z-axis. So therefore, those states are eigenstates, and nothing's going to happen to them, right? So now I can say, I'm doing two experiments. The first is with neutrons having spin up. And the second, of course, is with neutrons having spin down. And now we have to worry about how do we take this magnetic interaction and convert it into a phase. Okay? And if we want to do that, it's always fun to have a Hamiltonian. So we'll use the Zeeman Hamiltonian, which says if I have two magnetic particles, they interact with each other by dipole-dipole interaction. Okay? You know? You knew it when you were three with refrigerator magnets. So, the Hamiltonian is gamma B times sigma Z. I mean, it should be B dot sigma, right? But I already told you the field was along the Z-axis. I'm going to drop the other two pieces. And gamma is the gyromagnetic ratio. So that's just a constant. All it says is how big is the magnetic moment of the neutron. And it's 1,800 hertz per gauss. So you know that the Earth's field is half a gauss. So if I had a neutron, then the neutron is processing at a rate of 900 hertz as it sits in the Earth's field. Yeah? And in the notes, I give you this number, I never actually use it, and I give it to you that's off by a factor of 10. But as I say, I never use it. Okay, so here we have the Hamiltonian for the interaction of the neutron with the field. That tells us the energy. Since we know the energy, I'm going to know the phase shift. But I need two more things. I need to know the length of that area that I'm applying the field. Notice, I'm applying the field only over this volume, so the field only shows up in one path. And of course, that's essential, right? If I apply the field over both paths, then it would look like a global phase and it would have no influence. Right, the only influences that are going to show up are phase differences between the paths. And so, the phase, well, it's going to depend upon the length of the sample divided by the velocity so that we can have a particular time, right? This piece here has units of frequency. We need a factor of 2 pi, gamma B0, B, no zero. And of course, the phase is dependent upon the spin state. So it's equal to plus or minus this divided by 2, depending upon whether I choose spin up or spin down. Okay? And so now then we have a phase. And we can see that as the neutrons go through here, we're going to introduce this phase separation. And I like this experiment because some years ago I was at a conference and two senior people in the field got up and debated whether there would be a reduction in contrast in this experiment. And the oldest guy in the field said, hey, this thing looks like the identity state, right? It's useful to describe an idempotent. I don't know if you've seen those, but those are idempotents equivalent to projectors. And you could say, ah, E plus is equal to that projector, and E minus, of course, is the one down. And therefore, the identity state is equal to E plus plus E minus. And so his argument, which had the ability of being wonderfully naive, says, hey, this is the identity state. We apply the identity state. Nothing's going to happen. There'll be no contrast. And the other person wanted to debate with him, but he couldn't very well articulate why. And they went on and debated and debated and debated and never actually did the calculation. And so as that works with theorists. But as experimentalists, right, we say, oh, hey, we're either going to do the calculation or we're going to do the experiment. And since I didn't bring a nuclear reactor to class, we'll do the calculation. Okay, let's just look at it in terms of a simple block picture. That's all we need. You can calculate the evolution. I give you all the calculations in a notebook. So, you know, feel free. But let's look at what happens. If I take the spin up case, then the first blade doesn't matter whether it's spin up or spin down, right? It rotates. And so we rotate. And okay, then we get this phase shift here. And here it matters, right? That we're going to go in this direction if it's spin up. Yeah?
I mean, don't quite understand why that argument, or why that argument was offered. Aren't some channels non-unital, so they don't preserve the identity? So why would one just assume that if you start with the identity state?
Well, okay, so the premise of my conversation was that he was wrong. And you know, after the fact, it's easy to beat up people for being wrong. So yes, we could list a whole slew of reasons why that wasn't a useful piece. But the part I want is going to show up here. And I won't worry about the linear algebra of channels. That, you know, those of you that have taken Emerson's course, how many people have taken Joseph Emerson's course? All right. Those of you would know it. But then I wouldn't be talking to the majority of the people in the room. Okay. So we've got this phase shift. And now let's just draw what happens for the other case. For the spin down case, then of course the phase has the opposite sign. And now, of course, what's going to happen is that we'll have a pi rotation, we'll have a phase flag, etc. We'll recombine the beams. But in fact, for most of this, it would be sufficient to then propagate the average of those vectors. The average, because at the end of the day, our detectors are independent of spin. So although I describe it here as two experiments, and the outcome is going to be incoherent. It's going to be the average outcome, averaged over a classical distribution of experiments. The classical distribution being that half the time we have this experiment and half the time we have that experiment. And there's no coherence between them. We have a classical distribution of experiments. We average the outcome and we get an incoherence. And now you see, we, if we want to describe this experiment, we need to do it in terms of the density matrix, because now we've moved inside the Bloch sphere and we're looking at mixed states. And of course, we can complete the experiment. The pi rotation would do that. The phase flag I'm going to ignore. And then we would come back here to the z-axis. So this would be the reduced amplitude. And in the notes, I calculate for that for you. Now I spent some time in the notes describing the interaction of the blade in terms of the transparency. So if I think about an angle of rotation, I can also describe it in terms of the probability that a neutron passes directly through, which is the transparency. And so as we change the transparency of the beam, you see that we add contrast in this case. And I'm showing you the wrong bloody figure. That's the figure in the case that we have that one up there. Go and look at it sometime, but I'm not going to show it to you right now. Here, we've changed the strength of the magnetic field. And as I change the strength of the magnetic field, you see that we lose contrast. And the nice piece that comes back with this is that as I increase the magnetic field, just changing the strength of the field over this, the contrast returns. Yeah?
So I have a problem. See, I mean, an original problem, the two-level system is classified by the Kx, right?
Yeah.
Now I introduce the spin, and the blade has nothing, has no effect on the spin effect.
Right? That's right.
So, I mean, so in this case, you actually do not rotate the spin to the z-axis, but
I'm not rotating the spin at all.
Yeah, but the BZ is only there. But how does phase affect the Kx state?
Thanks for the question. This isn't a phase of the rotation of the spin.
Yeah.
Right? This is a phase because I'm changing the potential that the plane wave of the neutron's moving in. Right? So I'm changing the momentum of the neutron depending upon the strength of this magnetic field. So think about this as having, let's just think about this one path. And now I have the neutron moving through that path. Okay? And now if its spin is up, it will be delayed. And if its spin is down, it'll separate. And it's that separation. And you can make an interferometer out of that. Okay? So there's an interferometer which is called a longitudinal Stern-Gerlach neutron interferometer. So they couldn't find a really good name. But it's based upon just that separation. Yeah? Okay. So we've got this phase separation, and now we see this nice piece that if I keep B small, then the contrast vanishes. And if I increase B further, it comes back. And of course that works experimentally too. And it keeps going. Why is that? Why does the contrast come back? And if you think about it in terms of this picture, you'll understand.
Well, it's just that the fate introduces, it's periodic, right?
So it wraps around.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. So that once each of these has evolved by 2 pi, we're back at the original state that we were at. Okay? And so the piece to say is that, yes, we don't actually lose this contrast, but that we can keep looking through it. Yeah? All right. Now, it's useful to remember that that we really do have these two. Oh yes, please.
So you said 2 pi, but what if we have pi? Then
yeah, that's a good question. I'll leave you to think about it. So now then, let's think about these two trajectories. Now notice, the trajectories for spin up and spin down are pure, right? And they live on the Bloch sphere. It's the same thing. So as I increase the magnetic field, then I can see, here I've plotted out 3 contrast curves for you. One for spin up, one for spin down, and of course the blue one for the average. So the blue is what you would see if you had, if you were looking at the neutron interferometer. And the other two are if you could remove, if you could be selective about the measurement. Instead of saying, oh, I'm going to do this experiment, or I'm going to do this experiment, if you could say, I'm only going to do this experiment. Right? And then, of course, you return to pure state dynamics. And this is a process we call post-selection. Right? That we can post-select an outcome based upon some element in this distribution. And if done cleverly, it can return contrast. That even, of course, when I go to the value, I can, but the contrast vanishes, then the individual spins would have contrast. So how do we do that?
Is post-selection just a mathematical trick?
No. We're experimentalists here. So we got to be able to do it experimentally. Yeah? Okay, so you say, hey, separate those two neutrons. So we can separate them here. Perhaps the nicest way of separating them is helium-3, which we're using as our detector, of course, has spin. And so if I make a spin-polarized detector, then, of course, it will only detect the opposite spin. Okay? So I can make the detectors spin-polarized, and then they'll neglect the other spin, or as you say, I could separate these beams further with the Stern-Gerlach experiment, okay? And then it really looks like post-selection, right? I do the experiment, and then I filter out of the outcome just those parts that I want to see this distribution, and then we can see the results. And, oh, it's up here. There's a set of curves showing the separation between the spin up and spin down states when we had a small magnetic field. Now tell me another way we could do this experiment. If I didn't want to change the detectors, what else could I do?
I'll just take a guess. If you apply like a magnetic field before the detector, so you know some would go up and the other would go down.
Mm-hmm. So you know, I could do something here. I'm going to lump that with the detector.
Okay.
Because I'll say, oh yeah, it all looks like what I'm detecting.
Right.
Someone else?
Changing the Lebanese phase thing.
The phase flag. Here.
Yeah, until you find the definitely.
I don't think it'll help you, because this is independent of that. What I was looking for is for you to say, well, we could just put in one spin state right at the beginning. So we could select the spin state here, and then of course I wouldn't need to have the spin independent detectors. Okay, and again, from my point of view, it looks sort of like post-selection, but of course it's pre-selection, right? We're taking that part of the neutron beam that we want for these. Okay? One of the problems asks you to show me that those two are exactly the same. Okay, so we'll stop here today. So we've gotten into the Bloch sphere, we've seen the need for a density matrix. But in this special case where we have a distribution of experiments described by a classical probability distribution, and we'll be able to generalize that next class. All right? So thanks much. If I get worried a little bit if I don't have more questions. So if there's things that you don't understand, come and see me. And if it's just all too slow, then I'll try to speed it up at some point. Thanks.